Honorable Ambassador, Mr. Vice Counsel, my friend Jorge Peña, and friends. For the past several years, I've been privileged to be one of the five attorneys representing the five heroes of Cuba. They are now approaching their eighth year in high security prisons in the United States. And I want to take this occasion to update you on their case and to ask you at this critical time to join with many others, many thousands in this country and throughout the world, demanding their immediate release. It's been 5 months now since we argued their case before the full 12 members of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia. I cannot say how this court will decide the case. We are awaiting a decision. But I can say something that was referred to by the ambassador. The year before, in 2005, 8 judges considered their case. 3 distinguished United States federal appellate judges in Atlanta, Georgia, and 5 judges of the UN Commission on Arbitrary Incarceration. And of the 8 judges who have considered the case in 2005, all 8 agreed that they never received a fair trial and that they should be released. And yet today, they remain in the custody of United States prison authorities. You would think that in a Department of Justice in the United States, which has over 7,000 active lawyers, they could convince one judge of the 8 that the trial was fair. But they were unable to convince even a single judge. And as we await the verdict of the 12 judges who are now considering their appeal, we should remain cautiously confident and optimistic that what the original 3 judges said was a perfect storm, to use their words, of intolerance and unfairness in their original trial will not somehow be converted into a bright, sunny day of fairness. So we hope that in the coming weeks and in the coming months, when we hear this decision, it will be a favorable one. But while we're waiting, and while we've been waiting since February when we argued the case, there have been some developments which are worth noting. In April of this year, several months after we argued the case, a man in Southern California by the name of Ferro was arrested. He had in his home 1,500 guns, including 35 machine guns, 130 silencers, 89,000 rounds of ammunition, and rocket launchers. Why did this man in California have this arsenal in his house? The answer is provided in official court papers, which his lawyers filed last month. And the reason his lawyers contend he had this arsenal was because he was part of a militant group that was seeking to overthrow the government of Cuba. And just last week, his legal team in California was joined by another attorney named Hernandez, Arturo Hernandez. Arturo Hernandez is one of the six lawyers defending a case in Florida involving a man named Santiago Alvarez. And what did his client Alvarez do in Florida? He had in his house thousands of guns, many thousands rounds of ammunition, grenades, and rocket launchers. And why did Alvarez in Florida have this arsenal in his house? Again, his lawyers contend he had it because he was part of a militant group that seeks to overthrow the government of Cuba. So since we have argued the case in February, in these short 5 months since, there have now been an incident in California and in Florida, on both coasts of the United States, where in residential houses, thousands of guns have been found, rocket launchers, grenades, explosives, and other ammunitions, all being held to join the effort to overthrow the government of Cuba. So when people say to me that the threat against Cuba is a threat of words like the Bush plan, or the threat of Cuba somehow has subsided, we can point to them that in the last several months, armaments have been found both in the East and West Coast that are being held to militarily and violently overthrow the government of Cuba. But that isn't all that has happened. There has been a new revelation, which is rather remarkable. 1 month ago, a little more than a month ago, on June 22nd, the Miami Herald broke a story which was based on an interview by a man by the name of Lama. This is not the Dalai Lama. This is Jose Antonio Lama. And what did Mr. Lama tell the Miami Herald? He said that he was a member of the board of directors of the Cuban American National Foundation, a foundation funded in part by the US government. And that from 1994 to 1997, in that 3 year period, he contributed $1.4 million of his own money for an armed group to purchase radio-controlled light aircraft. And that purchase was matched by another man who he named, Domingo Cederny of Puerto Rico, who at the same time donated a helicopter to the group. And that donation was matched by a third individual who he named, Raul Lopez of Florida, who contributed explosives to that group. And when I read this a month ago, it all sounded familiar to me. And I went back through the trial record of the five. And what did I find? I found in the trial record a report that the five, when they were in Miami, monitoring these groups, an official report that they filed back to Havana, a report that the United States government came into possession by breaking into their apartments in Miami and downloading their computers. And what did that report say? The report said that there is a plan by an armed group for the purpose of launching two radio-controlled planes with explosives that would be remotely controlled by a helicopter and directed against a public gathering in the Plaza de la Revolución during a speech by the commander-in-chief. So now it all makes sense to me. Mr. Lama, with his light radio-controlled aircraft that he purchased, as he told the Miami Herald, and Mr. Saderni, who provided the helicopter, and Mr. Lopez, who provided the explosives, had a plan, which the five had intercepted back then and reported back to Cuba. That's what they were doing in the United States. This is the first case of an allegation of espionage where the government conceded that it didn't have a single page of classified material to show the jury because they were monitoring armed mercenary groups that were plotting actions like directing a radio-controlled plane loaded with explosives into a mass public gathering in order to kill as many innocent civilians as possible. And so when we look now at the recent revelations, all newly discovered evidence, we have Ferro in California, Alvarez in Miami with the weapons in their homes, and Lamas, who's now conceding and telling the story of what he did in 94 and 97, all of them confirming now the defense that was put forward in Miami as to what the five were doing and how their work was saving lives and attempting to report on these plans of armed actions. Well, that's not all that we have that's new that I can report to you. Because on June 15th, probably most of you know, that the Board of Education in the city of Miami voted to exclude from their library a book called Vamos Cuba, a book for children to read about Cuban school children, informing the school children in Miami that the school children in Cuba go to school every day, study hard, live their lives. But that book was unacceptable to the Board of Education and the city of Miami. And so they took the extraordinary step, which a federal judge has now condemned, of excluding that book from the library in the public schools because it puts Cuban school children in a favorable light. You know, when we argued the case in February before that appellate court, the government attorney who argued said they could get a fair trial in Miami because those attitudes toward Cuba and the violence that it caused in Miami as well as in Cuba is a thing of the past. It doesn't happen now. It happened in the 60s and 70s, but it doesn't happen now. But when we read the record of the school board in Miami, and when they voted to exclude that book, one of the members of the school board, Robert Ingram, who said he wasn't for that ban on that school book, but he added, "If I don't vote for it, I'm afraid I might find a bomb under my automobile." And then he added, "I simply can't vote my conscience now without feeling threatened." And he voted for the ban. Exactly the feeling of the 12 jurors who heard the evidence in the case of the five. We informed the court that those 12 jurors living in the city of Miami could not in good conscience vote an accurate view of the evidence. Because why? They would be afraid of finding a bomb under their automobile. And they were afraid of what could happen to them. And that's why that trial had to be reversed and the conviction set aside, as a three-judge panel found on August 9th in 2005. So since we've argued the case in February before the full court, after the government appealed our victory, we have found evidence that supports the defense that Cuba was under attack and they were monitoring the activities of the mercenary forces that threatened Cuba. And we have evidence that Cuba, that Miami to this day, is a community that is wrapped in fear of what the militants in the exile community might do if people vote their conscience. And so I have to say, I don't know if the judges of the 11th Circuit have read the newspapers, and if they're even aware of these events. We cannot file this information with the court at this time. We probably will if we lose and ask for a rehearing. But I have a feeling that they do know, these events are happening, that they do know the Carriles case is being heard, and that they do know his involvement, and that they do know that Mr. Bosch went on television in the Miami area, also in April, to justify the downing of the Cuban airliner in 1976. So I feel if there is any shred of justice left, and the 11th Circuit is a difficult court, my colleagues who practice in Georgia, which I do not, have told me that this court of 12 judges has not, in the past quarter century, ever ruled in favor of a criminal defendant on an appeal. So those are the upside odds. But at the same time, we have to bear in mind that it was this same court that sent Elian home after he was held as a hostage in Miami by distant relatives. So we have to keep an open mind. We have to hope that the evidence is known, that the evidence is being honestly dealt with and reviewed. The last three-judge panel that we argued this case to, that decided in our favor, reviewed the case for 16 months. We are now in 5 months of the 12 judges reviewing it. So we have to keep our optimism and keep our hope alive. But what's most important for now, and I'll close with this, is that we remain united and we make our voices heard, because experience has shown that in the United States, if there is support, and if that support is manifested throughout the country, that the courts do listen and do follow the law. It happened with Angela Davis, and it happened with many others in the 60s and 70s who had the support. So I ask you, and I thank you, for your support and for your being here. And I hope working together, we build that support and the momentum and hopefully achieve a victory. Thank you.